From Florida to Ohio, Mississippi to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, unemployment is down and the economy is in high gear. Veronique Berugi of the Mercatus Center is here to talk about the robust Trump economy. It is one of the most unlikely of places in the country for a tax revolt, but California voters are rebelling against a gas tax and it could have national implications. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Trustees of the Social Security system are predicting insolvency by 2034. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to explain why. And it was the assassination that stunned America and roiled a presidential election. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary on the death of Robert Kennedy. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Since the election of Donald Trump as president, the equity markets are up, unemployment is down, and the economy is in high gear. Here to talk about why we're headed in the right direction is Veronique Berugi. Veronique is a senior policy analyst at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, before we get into discussing why the economy is going in the direction it is going and what challenges might lie ahead, the May numbers have come out. It looks like unemployment is headed in the right direction. The economy is headed in the right direction. Give us a little bit of an overview as to what the economic landscape looks like now.
We are about 9 years, I guess, officially out of the recession, and the economy continues to add a lot of jobs. In May, it was 223,000 jobs. These are non-farm jobs, and that's on the tail of 160,000 jobs added in April, and it's a pretty constant number. I mean, it's been growing regularly. The economy is also growing at a faster pace than certainly it was growing during the recession, but also in the last 4 years. So the economy is doing well. Unemployment is trending down. And even if you take under consideration a better look, a better number that looks at the health of the labor market, basically, which includes people who are partially employed, or it all looks better. It certainly looks like the economy is doing well.
To what degree, Veronique, would we give credit to the tax cuts that were enacted at the end of last year are now starting to perk through the economy? Is that helping to supercharge these numbers or at least accelerate the growth of the economy?
The economy, I mean, it's worth saying that it was growing somewhat like this the previous year. But it's important to understand like how the tax cuts will work. So especially on the corporate income tax side, which is where the growth is going to come from. So the way economists understand corporate income tax rate cuts to work to produce higher economic growth is that when you cut the rate, basically companies have an incentive to invest more in capital, and then it creates more innovation, but it also makes workers more productive. And as they invest and create more, the economy is growing, but also workers are benefiting quite dramatically by their improvement in productivity. That takes a while, so it's unclear that a lot of what we see is a direct result from the tax cuts, because that will take really to manifest, to reach its full potential. It takes a while. However, there's expectation of all of this, and there's definitely an optimism that came from tax reforms, and the understanding that this is becoming a better environment to invest, a better environment to make business decisions. It's also, there's been some progress on the regulatory front, some deregulation happening. So definitely the policies put in place deserve some credit.
As we look at this environment, then, the fact that these tax cuts have been enacted and businesses can react accordingly, as you've mentioned, the Trump administration has made considerable progress in reducing regulations, although more progress needs to be made going forward. Yes. all of this has created a more stable environment. And how important is it to the economy, Veronique, that as businesses look out there, they have some predictability as to where we're going in the future?
It's extremely important. I mean, and it's not just the fact that they passed the tax cut and they're actually, there's been some deregulations happening. I mean, and again, as you said, there's so much more that needs to be done. It's the fact that this is an administration, for the most part, that is actually friendly to business and is not constantly talking about how business needs to be punished, either with higher taxes or with whatever enforcement mechanism that the government has at its disposal to punish businesses. And the reason why this matters is that uncertainty in the market creates paralysis. And paralysis means no investment. When you're worried about the environment, and like if you make an investment now and then you're stuck and the environment, the tax environment or regulatory environment changes, that actually is such a risk that companies don't really like this and they hold off from investing. Now, I will say that there is some problem and uncertainty created because of the trade, erratic behavior of the Trump administration on trade. And that creates uncertainty. But trade is a third of our economy, so it's important. But it hasn't yet gone to the point where it creates so much anxiety that you can really see it in the numbers.
As we look at challenges going forward, one of the drags on the economy in recent years has been healthcare, Obamacare, the cost of healthcare. Is that something that we still need to be concerned about? Has there been any movement on that front?
There's been some movement in the administration through executive orders, been trying to do some healthcare reform, but they really haven't done it in a way that's permanent. The problem with executive orders is they could be reversed the next time someone else is in office. And you're right, the growth of healthcare costs, I mean, the weight of healthcare on our economy is a significant problem, not just through how much the government spends, but there's such a large amount of our private resources that are directed towards healthcare that there's an opportunity cost in terms of investing in something else. And that is, I don't see us having addressed that problem in a significant way yet.
We have been talking with Veronique Deroughi, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, that at George Mason University. And Veronique, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where can folks go to read your writings on the web?
The Mercatus Center is a university-based research center at George Mason University. We're nonpartisan. We do economic issues. And you can go and find my work, but also all my wonderful colleagues' work at mercatus.org. Pretty much everything we do everywhere, whether it's through my syndicated column Reason or I write occasionally for the New York Times, everything is reposted, as is the work of my colleagues, on the Mercatus website. So you can find it for everything there.
Veronique Deroughi of the Mercatus Center. Veronique, thank you again for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
At the Club for Growth, Andy Roth is keeping track of all the many state-by-state primaries that are occurring around the country. We had a big one in California last week. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And in terms of that California primary, what turned out to be maybe not as important as the individual races is this whole gas tax issue that is roiling the political environment in that state. Can you give us some background on that, and why is it important?
This is a really fun story. Every once in a while, this sort of thing happens in politics, and it happened last Tuesday. Unfortunately, the beginning of the story begins last year. The California legislature decided to raise the gas tax, the state gas tax, among other things. And it is wildly unpopular, so much so that one of the lead sponsors of the gas tax got recalled. And if your listeners have ever heard of recall, a lot of Western states have it. It's not really a thing among the Eastern states, but Western states allow for a member of the legislature or any politician that I'm aware of in the state to be booted out of office if the voters are hell-bent enough. And so what happened was the California activists were able to put a recall election on the ballot for a Democrat state senator named Josh Newman, who was a big supporter of that gas tax. And they were successful. They kicked him out of office because they hated that thing so much. Now, that's an interesting little story from last Tuesday. But the broader story is that the activists across California have spent an enormous amount of time and capital to get the gas tax itself put on the ballot to repeal it. And they have successfully done that. So this November, when the Democrats and the Republicans go head-to-head in California up and down the coast, they're going to have to vote on this gas tax repeal on the ballot as well. And one of the reasons why it's important, besides the fact that that's bad policy and it should go away, is that it will increase turnout for Republicans. California is a very blue state, and there are a lot of House seats that are in jeopardy, and there's a governor's race. And by having this unpopular gas tax, the repeal of the unpopular gas tax on the ballot, that will help Republicans' chances up and down the ticket. So it was a wonderful thing what taxpayers did last Tuesday, and hopefully they can carry the torch all the way into November.
As we look at California and its strategic importance nationwide here, Andy, having this gas tax and an enhanced Republican turnout, Democrats are really pinning their hopes of regaining control of the U.S. House of Representatives on flipping a number of those congressional seats. So does this really magnify the importance of that ballot question?
It does. Conventional wisdom, and I do believe that in this case conventional wisdom is correct, is that in order for Democrats to regain the House, they basically have to be very successful in a handful of states, and that includes New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and California, and to some extent Pennsylvania. So if Republicans can take California off the table, so to speak, for the Democrats, then it may allow them to keep the majority in the House.
Aside from California, then, we have upcoming primaries this coming week in five states: Maine, North Dakota, Nevada, South Carolina, and Virginia. Let's talk about a couple of key races in those states, starting with the Old Dominion, a rather interesting and exciting U.S. Senate race in Virginia. What's happening there?
The focus of all the Senate races across the country has been on these Trump states held by Democrat senators, and those are like West Virginia and North Dakota and Montana. And those are all important, and I hope that Republicans are able to win those. But further down the line is Virginia, which is basically like the 10th or 11th most competitive Senate races. And by that, I mean it's not that competitive. Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's running mate, is the incumbent there. And most people think that he's going to breeze through and win re-election. But there is an upcoming primary for the Republicans, and one of the candidates is Nick Freitas. Now, he's not a household name, but he's a state delegate in the House of Delegates in Virginia, and he is just an absolute rock star. He is of the mold of Rand Paul and Mike Lee and Ted Cruz in the Senate. And if he and what's actually unique about his candidacy is that the establishment likes him as well. So if he's able to win the primary this coming Tuesday, then the enthusiasm for him may actually start to make that race competitive. And that would be a really exciting thing, to add yet another race to the Democrats' plate of vulnerable seats that Republicans can try and pick up. So we're looking at that race quite a bit.
With the national generic ballot test having drawn about even, maybe even slightly in Republicans' favor, Andy, are Democrats, with a race in Virginia perhaps on the competitive scale now, are Democrats starting to get spread a little bit thin in terms of their efforts to defend, what, more than twice the number of seats Republicans have up this year?
Well, yeah, that's definitely the hope. In fact, there was a House seat in Virginia's 5th District that just became open, and Democrats were salivating because they already thought that they had an opportunity there, and if the Republicans picked the wrong candidate there, they thought they could play there. And if they're able to play there, then they're able to increase turnout overall for the state and make Kane even more impenetrable when it comes to his election in November. But Republicans picked a good candidate in the 5th. It's my hope that they can take that race off of the Democrats' plate. And if they do that, then they'll be able to depress turnout for the state Senate race. And then to your point broadly, that is exactly the goal, is we want to spread the Democrats as thinly as possible and make them spend money where they didn't want to. And hopefully that's going to be the case coming up.
And in South Carolina, at least one interesting congressional race there.
Yeah, so everybody knows, I think everybody knows Trey Gowdy. He's become a household name just because of his constant fights with the Democrats over Benghazi and a few other things. He is retiring after 8 years, and his seat is now up for grabs. It's such a conservative district that the winner of the primary this coming Tuesday is likely going to be the next representative from that district. The Club for Growth PAC, the group that I support, we have endorsed Josh Kimbrell, and he is in the race with three other viable candidates, we think. One important note is that nobody is likely going to get 50% on Tuesday of the vote, so there will be a runoff in late August, so 2 months later, to actually determine the final winner. But we like Josh. We think he's got an excellent chance, and we hope that he wins on Tuesday.
And we will, of course, next week talk about results in all of these primaries and look at the others upcoming as the primary season is in high gear. And Andy Roth at the Club for Growth is keeping track of all of this for us. Andy, a few words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Social Security will go bust by 2034 unless changes are made. Here with details is Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
While President Donald Trump and the cable news networks were distracted by the kerfluffle that occurred at the White House on Tuesday when the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles refused to go, or maybe had the event canceled by the president, or whatever may have happened there, there was some actually really important news out of the Social Security Administration that you may have missed because it just, well, wasn't as exciting as football and the White House. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. There's no guest for me this week. Instead, as I said, we're taking a look at this very important and maybe even dangerous news that came out of the Social Security Administration and from the Medicare trustees on Tuesday. They say that Social Security will be insolvent by 2034. That's 3 years sooner than previously projected, and one of the major funds within Medicare will run dry even sooner than that, in 2026. And this is, again, according to a pair of reports released Tuesday by the trustees of the two big entitlement programs. Now, if you're like me, if you're a 31-year-old who has never really harbored any expectation whatsoever of receiving benefits from either one of those programs, then you might have actually greeted this news with a small degree of cynical relief, because this means you'll only have to spend another decade or so throwing a portion of your paycheck into the black hole that is Social Security and Medicaid, right? It's fine. It's fine. You can have a moment to celebrate. Go ahead. I'll wait. Okay. So by now, that feeling of relief is probably fading away. It should be settling into the pit of your stomach and transforming into a pang of fear and loathing. Because the people responsible for solving this looming crisis, and that's what it is, regardless of what you think of these entitlement programs, and the people who are responsible for mediating what's sure to be a nasty debate over the future of both programs, well, they spent Tuesday acting like there's hardly anything more important or more serious facing the country than whether a bunch of rich jocks show appropriate fealty to the president's opinions. In other words, we might be screwed. Let's review. Social Security is a $900 billion program that provides benefits to more than 67 million Americans. About 47 million of them are over age 65 and retired, while the majority of the rest are disabled, and then there's some who retired early and qualify for a number of different reasons. If you're within 15 to 20 years of that 65-year-old threshold, then you're probably not relying on that Social Security income yet, but you're likely depending on it being there as part of your future financial plan. Medicare, on the other hand, provides health care benefits to about 57 million older Americans, more than twice as many people as had their insurance coverage disrupted or canceled by Obamacare. Twice as many. And you remember how big of a deal, rightly, how big of a deal it was when Obamacare threw people off their insurance plans. So this is potentially very disruptive to people's retirement plans and to their health care. And it's important to remember that all this talk about insolvency for Social Security or Medicare is not the same as bankruptcy, which would mean that the two programs are completely out of money. By 2026 and 2034, respectively, Medicare and Social Security will not have enough money to pay the full cost of their obligations. But that's not the same as saying they'll have no money at all. According to the new trustee report, Social Security beneficiaries will face about a 21% across the board benefits cut when insolvency hits. So that means you get 79 cents for every dollar that you were expecting. Medicare's insolvency is a little bit different, a little more complicated. It will hit the program's hospital fund first. Medicare has a variety of different programs that fund different things. And without changes, the program will only be able to pay for about 91% of costs in 2026. And then those numbers will steadily decline unless there is serious reform. Now, none of this is to suggest that these programs are actually worth saving. They're dinosaurs that were designed more than half a century ago for an entirely different workforce and population. For example, when Social Security was launched in 1935, the average life expectancy for Americans was 61 years. Yes, that means the average person died 4 years before they qualified for Social Security benefits. Today, the two programs mostly function just as a giant conveyor belt to transfer wealth from the young and relatively poor to the old and relatively rich, allowing the average person, who now lives to be 78, by the way, more than a decade of taxpayer-funded retirement. Entitlements are also the primary driver of our national debt, which just hit $20 trillion, you may have heard, and is on pace to reach levels not seen since World War II by the middle of the next decade. So these two entitlement programs are not working. At least they're not working for the long term, and they should be completely revamped. But do you really believe that Congress and the current president are up to the task? I mean, they might not even pass a budget this year. Nothing on entitlements will get done before the midterms, that's for sure. And the 2020 presidential race will begin as soon as the last votes are counted on November 6th of this year. Normally, a presidential race might be a pretty good opportunity to have a serious debate about the future of two of the federal government's biggest expenditures. But sadly, these are not normal times. And by the time 2021 rolls around, that's another 3 years from now, maybe someone will be ready to do something about Tuesday's news. The news about the entitlements, I mean, not about whether football players stand for the national anthem. But when that happens, if that ever happens, both programs should be restructured to take care of the truly needy rather than just being benefits for anyone who reaches an arbitrary age, 65 or 67, or raise it wherever you want. That doesn't really solve the problem. The Wall Street Journal notes this week that there were 2.8 workers for every Social Security recipient last year. That's down from 3.3 workers per recipient in 2007. And it's way down from more than 5 workers per beneficiary that existed back in 1960. Those demographics, unfortunately, are destiny. As America ages, this year will mark the first time since 1982 that Social Security has spent more money than it takes in. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan federal think tank, says that the gap will continue to grow, leaving the program with a $900 billion deficit over the next decade. I think we should leave off here with the words of Mitch Daniels, the former governor of Indiana and the current co-chair of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Writing in the Washington Post yesterday, he said that a well-functioning democracy would by now have had a mature national discussion marked by the recognition of the need to set priorities among finite resources as well as the intergenerational unfairness of the status quo. Regrettably, Daniels said, and I have to agree with him on this point, our republic doesn't seem capable right now of discussions like that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll be back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It has been 50 years this month since an assassin's bullet ended the life of Robert F. Kennedy and essentially brought to an end the era of Camelot. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
It was 50 years ago this June that a shocking moment of violence rocked America and the world, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. The tragic moment came shortly after midnight, June 5th, 1968, at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. It should have been a great night for Bobby, one of celebration. He had just achieved a grand political victory, having won California in the Democratic primary. He was surely on his way to the party's presidential nomination. But not everyone in that building had similar plans. After giving his inspiring victory speech, Kennedy was led from the podium and toward the hotel exit via a carefully pre-selected back route through the kitchen. But someone was waiting, hiding along that path. As people pressed in to see the senator, a 24-year-old Palestinian-Jordanian immigrant named Sirian Sirian jumped out from behind a cart stacked with trays next to an ice machine and began firing a .22 revolver at Kennedy. He lodged three bullets in his intended victim, one of them directly in the head, entering behind the right ear and piercing into RFK's brain. He went down. He would never stand again. Why did Sirian Sirian pull that trigger? Well, the answer was simple. The young Palestinian was seeking vengeance against the New York senator for his support of Israel in the Six-Day War the previous June. Yes, looking back, this was the first major manifestation of Middle East terrorism in the United States, long before September 11, 2001. Sirian was already vehemently anti-Israel when the Jewish state defeated the Arab states in the Six-Day War. He vowed revenge, with Bobby the chosen outlet for his anger. His rage at RFK went ballistic. He scribbled maniacally in his diary on May 18, 1968, quote, "My determination to eliminate RFK is becoming more the more of an unshakable obsession. RFK must die. RFK must be killed. RFK must be assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated before 5 June 68," unquote. It is crucial to understand that this was a deadly act prompted not only by the evil of Middle Eastern terrorism, but also, albeit quite forgotten, by the evil of Soviet communism. And what did the Soviets have to do with this? Well, the answer? The Six-Day War had been shamelessly provoked by the Kremlin. Looking to exploit divisions in the Middle East and further exacerbate America's foreign policy problems at the time, especially in Vietnam, Soviet officials in May 1968 cooked up false intelligence reports claiming that Israeli troops had been moved into the Golan Heights and were ready to invade Syria. Moscow peddled the malicious disinformation to Egypt and other Arab states. The Kremlin wanted to provoke a military confrontation with Israel, and guess what? It worked. In fact, on this, there is no debate. It is a historical certainty. Moscow precipitated the Six-Day War in June 1967, which, in turn, prompted RFK's assassin in June 1968. At the time of his death, Robert F. Kennedy was only 42 years old. Had he lived to win the presidency, he would have been 43 at his inauguration, the same age as his late brother at his swearing-in. And his shooter was 24 years old, the same age as Lee Harvey Oswald, the shooter of his late brother. So today, 50 years later, that shooter, Sirian Sirian, is still with us. Bobby Kennedy is long gone, and who knows what might have been. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WWSM-AM in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, KEST-AM in San Francisco, California, along with KTLX-FM in Columbus, Nebraska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.